taking their place in a long true line of everyday Americans,
helping to secure the blessings of liberty to ourselves and our posterity. This is the Constitution Study on the America Out Loud Network with your host, Paul Engel.
Pay the bills, stay out of jail, love the neighbors and have a few good friends. Every day you are everyday Americans.
Hello there, everyday Americans, and welcome to the Constitution Study. This is where we read and study the Constitution. We teach the rising generation to be free. I am glad you could join me. You know, there's been a lot of talk lately about voting, voting rights, and the need to, quote unquote, save our democracy. You know, voting is the foundation of our democracy. Well, I want to remind people, we're not a democracy, but we are a republic. And republic exists when the people hold the power and they delegate that power to elected representatives, which means, yes, voting, elections, how that all works, that is very, very important. If we can't trust our elections, how do we trust that we've got the people we wanted representing us exercising our power in our name? Now, they've been complaining about elections, well, for decades now. I mean, it really kicked off back in 2000 with all the hanging chads and pregnant chads and who knows what's going on with the craziness in Florida. Pretty much ever since, we've watched elections being challenged. Now, for the most part, it was Democrats challenging when Republicans won the presidential election. That's the one we seem to be the most focused on because we're all federally focused. But I want to tell you, we had an issue here in 2020, and there was a lot of problems. And I've talked in the past about that, about the problems with states illegally appointing electors, doing so in violation of the Constitution. But here's what I want to talk about. We've had this push to federalize the election process. But if we don't understand elections and how they're set up and how they're supposed to work, how do we make them free, fair, and transparent? Well, then we're just letting other people decide who should be in charge of our country, who are employees in Congress and the presidency should be. So I want to take a look at some recent stories about the elections, the election process, and then see if we can come up with an overview of how things are, maybe things we should consider for the future. And then I want to end up the program with my Q&A segment. I've got enough questions. I have a Q&A segment for the end, but we're going to start with this question of voting. Now, President Biden said, "The battle for the soul of America is not over. We must stand together so that January 6th does not mark the end of democracy, but the beginning of a resistance for our democracy." Give me a break. I feel like I got a gag. As I said, we are not a democracy. And in fact, when I hear most people say we must do this to protect our democracy, I'm really thinking what they mean is they want to protect the Democratic Party. Now, there were illegal actions taken during January 6th. There's evidence that people people vandalized the property. There is some evidence that people entered the property without permission. There's a whole question about public property and all that, but there's also evidence that the police actually assaulted people, and that in many cases the police let people into the Capitol. So there's lots of stuff going on. And I doubt we will ever get to the truth. But was January 6th the end of democracy? Well, absolutely not. Because while many of the people did act badly, and some claiming that there were people planted to make it even worse than it was than the organizers wanted, January 6th was in large part looking at it saying, there were issues with the elections. As I said, at least five states illegally appointed electors. The Constitution requires that electors be appointed in a manner chosen by the legislatures of the several states. This comes from Article 2, Section 1, Clause 2. Each state shall appoint in such manner as the legislature thereof may direct, a number of electors equal to the number of senators and representatives to which the state may be entitled in the Congress. So when five states that I know of, where the courts determined the manner of appointing electors, they changed the rules because the state legislature, okay, we're going to allow the people to vote. That vote will allow them to choose pools of electors based on preferred candidates. And this is how that election is going to happen. So when you have courts that come in and say, no, we're going to change the rules because we think they should be different. Well, that may be illegal for other state elections. It may be legal for local elections. It may even be legal for elections of senators and representatives. It is not legal for presidential elections because it violates Article 2, Section 1, Clause 2. The legislature didn't determine the manner of choosing electors. It was modified by courts, and in some cases modified by the executive. So many people showed up on the Capitol January 6th to protest those problems. They were also protesting, by the way, the belief, some of it with evidence of fraud and other malfeasance during the counting of the elections. But it certainly, January 6th, certainly, in no way, shape, or form was a end of democracy. People did not show up armed. People did not, there was not an armed insurrection. There was not even an insurrection. There was an attempt by people to enforce the supreme law of the land. Now, I don't agree with how some of them did it, but again, it's the hyperbole. In fact, I'd go a step farther. I would say the way the current Congress is treating January 6th is a step towards the end of our republic. Because it is subverting the rule of law for political party advancement. Now, of course, that's not all Biden's been talking about. He's referring to voter ID laws and similar laws that say, listen, you have to show a voter ID. You can't have electioneering while in the location of polling, basic stuff like this. He refers to it as Jim Crow 2.0, or in some cases, even Jim Eagle. Now, I want to ask you, is it a violation of the law? Is it a suppression of voting to say, you know what, since voting is a right restricted to citizens in the United States, is it a crime? Is it a suppression of the vote to say, you know what, we want to make sure people that are voting actually are legally authorized to vote. Now, I agree. We have this thing called the 24th Amendment, which means you can't have a poll tax, meaning you can't force people to pay for an ID. So as long as those photo IDs are freely available at no charge, doesn't violate the 24th Amendment. But there are so many people who don't want that. Who don't want you to prove. Now, they want you to prove that you got vaccinated. They want you to show a photo ID to pick up, Sudafed at the grocery store. They want you to show a photo ID to take a tour of the Capitol, but they don't want you to show a photo ID to prove you are eligible to vote. Makes me wonder. And then again, this big push for mail-in voting. Mail-in voting is such a dangerous process. If you're worried about the future of our republic, if you are worried about the end of what you refer to as democracy, what better way to do that than to open up the elections to more vectors of fraud? Mail-in voting is dangerous. See, when I vote, I show up at my polling place. I show them a photo ID. What they hand me is a card. We have electronic voting in Tennessee. I'm not real thrilled with it. It's better than some, but they hand me a card that represents a ballot. And I walk up to a machine, and I stick the card in the machine, and the machine lights up, and it shows me the ballot, and I vote for who I want to. And then I submit my vote, and it says, "Are you sure?" And I say, "Yes, I'm sure." And then I take that and I hand that card to a poll worker where it gets recycled. Why is that important? The tool to vote never leaves my possession from the point that it is issued to the point that it is recycled. Nobody has the opportunity to take that card from me, stick it in a machine, and vote some way I don't want to. And once that card's been used, the system will not accept it again until it's been recycled, it's been reset. So someone can't come in and replace my vote or vote multiple times under that. There's control. Now compare that with mail-in voting. Now, I have done mail-in voting once and only once in my life. I did an absentee ballot because I was going to be out of town. I was actually going to be in 1,000, almost 1,500 miles away on election day. So I went to my county clerk and I said, "Hey, you know, I'm going to be out of town. Will you issue me a mail-in ballot?" I had signed something to prove that, yes, I was eligible and registered. And okay, they mailed me a ballot. I filled out the ballot and I sent it back. I did it because I was out of town. But imagine the process. The election board in your county mails ballots out. Now, if you requested a ballot and you're looking for the ballot and you receive the ballot, life is good. But what about all these places that simply send out ballots to everybody on the list, everybody who's registered? We saw reports in 2020 of homes getting 3, 5, 7, 9, 10 ballots for people who hadn't lived there in years, sometimes decades. So now you've got all of these ballots floating around, unclaimed ballots, and we're just going to assume that nobody would ever use that for nefarious deeds. No. Then what they say is, okay, you get the ballot, you fill it out, and of course, you can't put anything identifying that proves that you are who you say you are, right? So if they sent you a ballot, you can't put anything like, I don't know, the last four digits of your social security. They don't want you to do that. So the ballot was out of your control from the time it was issued until you received it in the mail. Then you take it and you drop it in the mailbox, and it's out of your control again until such time as it arrives back at the election board where it gets back in control of people who are in charge of this stuff. Now, I suppose if you had drop boxes, that would be a little better, as long as only certified election and, you know, election officials were actually picking up from the drop boxes. But can't you see there are more opportunities for malfeasance? Now, I'm saying that everybody's going to cheat. No, but we have to understand there will always be people looking for the opportunity to cheat. So the last thing we want to do is make it easier for them to cheat. So things like photo IDs, minimizing mail-in ballots, those to me are ways of minimizing the opportunities for cheating. So say, "Well, people can't vote." Well, show me where people are being disenfranchised from voting. Now, let's face it, we have early voting pretty much everywhere now. So there should be plenty of opportunities for someone to cast a ballot. And if somebody really, truly could not get to the polling place, all they have to do is request an absentee ballot. It's not as secure, but that certainly is better than simply opening up the world and saying, "Hey, we'll just throw these ballots out." And no one would ever actually, would never actually cast an illegal ballot. Crazy, huh? And of course, what's even worse than that is this idea of ballot harvesting, where we'll let just, you know, any Tom, Dick, or Mary pick up ballots from locations and bring them in, because nobody would ever abuse that system. I'm not saying that most people would. There are people who abuse that system. We saw evidence The California person who they found with 300 ballots in the back of his vehicle during the recall election for Governor Newsom. These are all situations that make voting less secure, not more secure. More likely to be wrong, in error. More opportunities for fraud and malfeasance. Yet, we have whole groups of people that are fighting these. Now, in Wisconsin, a county judge, he determined that there was no statutory authority in Wisconsin for either drop boxes or ballot harvesting, that they violate state law. Well, that's great. I mean, it's, a year and a couple of months after the 2020 election? So the good news is they won't have it for 2022 and 2024. Well, of course, unless that gets appealed and it continues to go round and round and round. So again, I want voting to be free, fair, and transparent. You need to have access to it. It needs to be sure that you get that one person, one vote. And everything needs to be transparent and open where people can see it, observe it, because it's the observation of problems that tells us something is wrong. Well, for example, a contract worker for a large Pennsylvania county filmed a Zoom meeting back in April of last year. And during this meeting, election officials, I believe they were election officials, were heard making, let's call it certain comments. The one official, a Ms. Perone, had a brief conversation with Jim, and quoting from the article, I'm reading this article off the Federalist, said, "And this time it's much different than last time because we're going to have them sign O's. They're going to be W-4s. We need them to sign something allowing somebody else to pick up. So we're going to actually follow the law fully this time." Now, the Federalist is still doing some investigation in this, but if they're talking about actually following the law fully this time, doesn't that kind of an admission that they didn't fully follow the law last time? Now, during the or after the election, Pennsylvania was one of the states. I worked with a couple of people in Pennsylvania that were trying to deal with the mess the courts had created when they changed the voting laws in the selection of presidential electors. But there were other problems. Now, I'm not saying any state is going to be perfect. But doesn't anybody else wonder? And according to the Federalists, they have other videos showing an array of troubling discussions related to the 2020 election, including Delaware County officials destroying election material or blocking out derogatory information in the copies made that were used to fulfill right-to-know requests. Now, these people are innocent until proven guilty. This should be investigated. If there's a probable cause that crimes were created, there should be charges filed. There should be a trial. They should be able to call witnesses. They should have the advice of counsel. And if they're convicted, they should be punished. But as more and more evidence comes up of problems and sometimes outright malfeasance during the election, isn't that something we should be dealing with? Shouldn't we be looking for ways to minimize those opportunities rather than leaving the opportunity open? And as we watch that, maybe the actions on January 6th, maybe the demonstration on January 6th doesn't sound quite so much as an insurrection, but a desire to restore the Constitution to its rightful place as the supreme law of the land. See, that's what concerns me about January 6th. It's become a political football. I doubt we will ever know the truth. But as interesting information comes out, we get little glimpses. For example, the only person that was actually killed during the demonstration on January 6th is a lady by the name of Ashley Babbitt. She was shot by a U.S. Capitol Police officer on January 6th. And a video has emerged that she was there trying to prevent rioters from vandalizing the doors leading to the speaker's lobby. This was not, as some people have referred to it, a rioter or a vandal. This was a woman trying to stop the vandalism. And then I found this other little tidbit. This was on the Federalist. There's a group called America First Legal. They have filed a brief with the Supreme Court. They are trying to get the court to weigh in on Donald Trump's executive privilege. See, back in December, former President Trump has petitioned the high court to keep White House records concealed from the House Select Committee on January 6th. Now, I'm sure there's a lot of nefarious reasons that people have put forth as to why the president would want to hide such information, but let's back it up just a bit. You see, the one thing that this Select Committee has shown to be is partisan. Yes, they have members of both parties, but it was the Democrats that assumed the authority to tell the Republicans who would not be acceptable to serve on this committee. Anybody that's expecting a free and fair review of the facts by this committee, well, I have some oceanfront property in Nevada to sell you. First of all, Congress has no investigatory powers. So this whole thing is nothing but a political witch hunt. Now, the former president is saying, listen, my material is covered under executive privilege. Now, the committee has spent months trying to seek several hundred pages of documents that are currently in the National Archives because they want to tie what happened on January 6th to Donald Trump. Again, not a surprise. This has pretty much been the modus operandi since the beginning of all this. But you see, President Trump says, excuse me, executive privilege. Now, what is executive privilege? Basically, executive privilege is, listen, when you have a conversation with the president, it's considered privileged information. In other words, if you have a private conversation with the president, kind of like if you were to have a private conversation with a doctor or a lawyer, that's considered privilege. Well, this it's a little bit reversed, right? In other words, when you have a conversation with the president, you're supposed to hold the privilege of keeping what was discussed with the president private. Just as a patient needs to give permission for a doctor to release confidential information, the president needs to give information to release private information from his from private meetings that were held with them. Now, again, President Biden has ordered the archives to release the records, even though President Trump has claimed privilege. Now, this gets into a very interesting legal fact, and I want to take just a moment to see if I can explain it well. Does the privilege remain with the office or the office holder? In other words, is it the office of president that determines whether or not something is held under privilege, or is it the person who held the office when the privilege communication happened? In other words, does the privilege belong to Donald Trump or to the office of president? And this is what's going to have to be dealt with ultimately, apparently, at the Supreme Court. Now, why is this important? Well, imagine every conversation had with the president is now open to public scrutiny. Now, let's just say, for example, the president of the United States calls on you to give him some advice. I don't care which president is. I don't care what the advice is about. But the president is calling you and he wants to have a private meeting with you to discuss something. Again, maybe it's advice, doesn't matter. It's a private information, it's not held out in public. But you see, the president's a public person. So imagine you have this sit down with the president, and you know that anything you say will one day could easily be shouted from the rooftops just because somebody wants it. Maybe you're going to be a little more circumspect in what you say, a little less forthright. See, that's the purpose of executive privilege, is to allow the president to get information without someone considering the political ramifications of what's being said in private. Now, executive privilege is not a constitutional issue. There's nothing in the Constitution that talks about executive privilege. This is going to be an interesting tete-a-tete. But again, for me, it's just one more example of how this whole January 6th thing is not about finding the truth. It truly has become a political witch hunt. And because you have a Democratic president, you have a Democratic Speaker of the House that is in an investigation, in a committee that's attempting to investigate primarily a former Republican president, a hated former Republican president, somehow this idea of it being bipartisan fact-finding, well, it just doesn't pass a smell test. Now, I have to head off to a break. Before I do, I'd like you to do a couple things for me. Check a couple things out. First, I'm going to answer questions after the break. So if you have a question you would like me to answer, obviously you're going to make this Q&A session, but go to constitutionstudy.com, click the Ask a Question, and ask your question, fill out the form, just hit the checkbox that says, you know, answer it on the radio, and I'll add it to my next Q&A session. More than happy to do that. Also, please check out constitutionscholars.com. You know, I'm starting my online Constitution study. You can find out more at constitutionstudy.com/study. The recordings of that are going to be available on Constitution Scholars. Scholars is my learning platform. It's my scholars platform. It's where people who are reading and studying, who want to be students of the Constitution, it's where we find each other, greet, meet, discuss, study, share information. And you can join that absolutely free. That's constitutionscholars.com. Also, please check out healthycell.com. Now again, vitamins really haven't changed much since the 1930s. Well, that is until Healthy Cell came along. They've reinvented the vitamin. They've developed this gel pack for those who have a hard time swallowing pills. And they have different formulas for your different needs. Now, maybe you have a problem sleeping. Maybe you are looking at COVID and you want to boost your immune system. Maybe you're having a hard time focusing on a task. Whatever it is, take a look. But I like the Immune Super Boost, especially when I'm traveling. When I'm out traveling, you're encountering a bunch of people, and I've done it for years. I've spent decades traveling for work, and you frequently come home with, I just call it the crud. That's where Immune Super Boost comes in. Help boost your immune system so it can fight off whatever you encounter, whether it's your day-to-day work or when you're off traveling, so that your body can defend itself. Now, as an America Out Loud listener, you get 20% off your first order. All you have to do is use a code OUTLOUD at checkout. Try any of their formulas. Sign up for a subscription. Just use that code OUTLOUD at checkout to get 20% off your first order.
You know, Healthy Cell is a terrific lineup of products. They have products that are pill-free, gel-pack vitamins. Looking for better sleep, focus, and energy? Check out Healthy Cell, the leading innovator in nutritional supplements for cell health. Healthy Cell has a product that helps REM sleep, helps you fall asleep, stay asleep, sleep deeply, and wake up refreshed with Healthy Cell's REM sleep supplement. The only sleep supplement that's designed to support all stages of sleep. And boy, is it needed now during all the stress of the COVID-19 pandemic. So go to healthycell.com and use the code OUTLOUD, all capital letters, OUTLOUD, for a 20% off your first order of any product from Healthy Cell. I use them every day. I believe in them, and you should too. Let's get real. Let's get loud on America Out Loud Talk Radio.
Trouble getting to sleep and staying asleep can be infuriating. Your mind races. You toss and turn, and the harder you try, the harder it is to drift off. And today's digital age makes it even harder. You're not alone with this struggle. Poor sleep affects over 70% of Americans. Even the Centers for Disease Control label insufficient sleep a public health epidemic. To take back your sleep, Healthy Cell has created REM Sleep, the only sleep supplement made to support all four stages of human sleep with calming herbs, amino acids, and sleep hormone support, delivered in a patent-pending, pill-free, ultra-absorption microgel formula that tastes great. Fall asleep, stay asleep, sleep deeply, and wake up refreshed with Healthy Cell's REM Sleep. Go to HealthyCell.com and use code OUTLOUD for 20% off your first order. That's HealthyCell.com, HealthyCell, and use code OUTLOUD for 20% off.
The American Constitution is the most magnificent document on earth. We are America Out Loud. Join us as we celebrate the genius of our founding fathers. So you can listen in on our free apps on Apple, Android, or Alexa. America Out Loud Talk Radio. Liberty and justice for all.
Welcome back, everyday Americans. You've rejoined the Constitution Study, where we read and study the Constitution. We teach the rising generation to be free. You know, the first half of the program, we talked about voting and January 6th and things along that line. But now it is time for questions and answers. That's right. I know it's a little cheesy, but I had to throw the cheer in there. These are all questions that came from the website. If you want me to answer your questions here online, here on the radio, go to constitutionstudy.com, hit the ask a question, just hit that checkbox that says answer on the radio, and I will do my best to answer it right here on the radio during my next Q&A session. Now, my first question comes from Brian. Brian says, does the 10th Amendment, quote unquote, police powers supersede the Second Amendment? If so, how? Well, first, let's answer a couple of, let's set a little background. All right, the 10th Amendment says nothing about police powers. The 10th Amendment is the separation of powers, specifically between the states and the federal government and the people. All right, so the 10th Amendment says the powers not delegated to the United States by the Constitution, nor prohibited by to the states, are reserved to the states respectively or to the people. Now, to be fair to Brian, there are a lot of lawyers that refer to police powers and the idea that since police powers are not specifically delegated to the United States, they remain with the states. So I think that's where he's coming from. But he does bring up to me what is an interesting question, and I've had to deal with this in a lot of my research. What happens if you have powers or rights that are in conflict? All right, so you've got a 10th Amendment power that says, hey, if it's not a power delegated to the United States, it's something the states can do. And you have a Second Amendment right that says, hey, wait a second, the people cannot have their right to keep and bear arms infringed. I know there are plenty of lawyers and judges and politicians who can't read that and understand that, but it says quite simply, the right of the people to keep and bear arms shall not be infringed. Period. End of story. But what happens when there's a conflict? And the most common place I see this actually revolves around property rights. Right? You have property. James Madison did an excellent essay where he goes into the details of what is property. And he defined property pretty much as not just something you own. It's what you have that you have exclusive control over. So, yes, you have, say, land or a car or a boat. That is property, and that we can readily understand. But he also said you not only have a right to property, you have a property in your rights. See, property is something you have exclusive control over. See, your body is your property, and you are supposed to have exclusive control over it. So when the Fifth Amendment says you cannot be deprived of life, liberty, or property without due process of law, they're talking about things like land. They're talking about things like your body. Madison, one of the things like your business, even what you choose to expend your skills on. These are all property. So where does this fit in with the Second Amendment? Well, the right to keep and bear arms shall not be infringed. And I've been asked this before, and I've seen a lot of people try to answer it, and they generally don't do it very well, but let me give this a shot. I own land. I have a piece of property in Middle Tennessee. It's my farm. It's where my family lives. It is my property. I have exclusive control over it. Now, let's say someone shows up to my property and they wish to carry a firearm on my property. Every year, I have a gentleman comes by. He asks for permission to hunt on my land. Every year, he comes back and renews that. He's asking for permission to carry a firearm and hunt on my land. And it's up to me whether or not he has that. But does your right to keep and bear arms, does this gentleman's right to keep and bear arms supersede my right to control access to my property? In other words, can a private person exclude the carrying of firearms on their property? And the answer is yes. And let me see if I can explain how this, the way I wrap my head around this. So you have a right to exercise your rights up until the point they infringe on someone else's rights. So in the situation with the hunter, he has a right to carry arms, but that right cannot be used to infringe on my right to control access to my my property. See, that would be him using his rights to supersede my rights. Now you may ask, where do you get that, Paul? Well, you go back to the Declaration of Independence, it says all men are created equal. If his rights supersede my rights, we are not equal, are we? So you cannot use one set of rights to infringe on another person's rights. Another example, right? We've seen this on college campuses where people claim the right to free speech to infringe on a person's right to speak freely. Someone comes to speak on campus and there's a group that doesn't like them. So what do? They show up and they shout their opponents down. Now they have a right to speak freely, but they're using it to infringe on the rights of someone else. That's where things fall apart. By the way, that's also where those little signs indoors that say no firearms allowed on this property. That is, if you're dealing with a private business, not a public place like a courthouse or a public office building, right? You're talking about private business. They have a right to control under what conditions people are allowed onto their property. And that is you know, a lot of people get upset about that, but that's private property. If you can't do it to your neighbor, doesn't matter if they're a business or a person, that is the limitation. If you use the only legitimate use of a right is one that does not infringe on the rights of another. Now, Brian went into another question, which is something he's working on, but it's understanding there's a federal law, Title 18, United States Code, Section 926A. And this is meant to deal with states that infringe on the Second Amendment. And the logic being that the law says that if you are in a place where you can legally carry a firearm, legally possess a firearm, and you are traveling to a place where you can legally possess a firearm, even though you are traversing a place where you are not legally allowed to own a firearm, federal law says you can transport through that spot because your origin and your destination, you're both legal. And this is used a lot in places where you've got, you know, neighboring states that don't recognize your right to keep and bear arms, don't recognize the Second Amendment of the Constitution. So, for example, I travel to do shows and events and stuff like that. And if I'm traveling from a state where I am legal to another state where I'm legal, but I'm going through a state that doesn't recognize it, I can still carry my firearm. I just can't be carrying it on me. It needs to be unloaded, locked, and inaccessible to the passenger compartment. That was part of what he's talking about. It's a workaround to states that basically ignore the Constitution of the United States. So, next question. This one's interesting. This one, they the title of the question is, how do you impeach a Supreme Court justice? This comes from Debbie. And Debbie was commenting on, let's say, the recent actions of Justice Sotomayor and how she went about doing this. So she goes, how do we hold her accountable? Should she be removed or replaced with a fair judge who respects the duty and authority given? How do you remove, how do you impeach a Supreme Court justice? There's a couple things that I want to include in this answer. Right? First, federal judges do not serve lifetime appointments. I know, you've heard it over and over and over again, but I'm going to repeat myself. Federal judges do not serve lifetime appointments. Article 3, Section 1 reads, the judges of both the Supreme and inferior courts shall hold their offices during good behavior. Now, the question I'm often asked is, well, who defines good behavior? And that's actually a very good question. First, your representatives in the House of Representatives. See, the House has the sole power of impeachment. So it's the members of the House that ultimately determine the first step of, is it good behavior? That is then tried in the Senate, and they get the say as to whether or not that behavior was bad or not. Now, this is important because if you look at a lot of these, you've got judges that are ignoring the Constitution. I talked earlier this week about the OSHA and the HHS mandates and how the question was never really asked, does the Constitution authorize the federal government, the United States, to actually do these types of things? So, but what is the process? How do you impeach a Supreme Court justice? Well, if you want to start at the beginning, the people of this country contact their House reps. The House rep may do it on their own, but generally, they should be hearing from their constituents saying, listen, here are the bad actions. Now, sadly, it's been my experience that most people that are requesting the impeachment of a federal officer don't come up with a truly constitutionally sound argument. I'm not saying that the person should not be impeached. I'm saying the way the argument is put forward is often wrong. So let's take a situation like a Justice Sotomayor. If you wish a justice like Justice Sotomayor to be impeached, the first thing you have to do is come up with a constitutional reason, examples, evidence of her not behaving, of her bad behavior. Since she holds that office only during good behavior, the first step you have to do is come up with, well, what is the bad behavior? Now, the argument that Debbie made, to me, is not a sound one. It's not based on evidence. I thought Sotomayor's arguments in these cases were ridiculous, but I'm looking at what this person specifically asked, what Debbie asked. So I'd recommend, Debbie, you need to come up with a good constitutional argument. Take examples from her test, from her dissent in the OSHA or the opinion in, well, you can't really do it from the opinion because I don't think she did a concurrence. So look at the dissent in the OSHA case. Look at the oral arguments in both the OSHA and both OSHA and HHS cases and find where she violated her oath of office. See, Article 6, Clause 3 said, basically, every officer at the state and federal level must swear or affirm to support the Constitution. You're making an argument. She's ignoring what the Constitution says. You have to build an argument that way. Right? What you're trying to do is you're trying to basically give your representative the tools they need to make an impeachment stick. So you build that argument, you write it up, you send it to them. And you probably have to send it to them over and over and over again to get through all the noise of what they listen to. But eventually, if enough people did this, you would have multiple House members saying, you know what, that's right, she has behaved badly. It is sufficient enough to warrant removal from office. They file what are called articles of impeachment. This then goes through the whole machinations of the House and eventually gets either, if it makes it out of committee, gets voted on by the House. If a majority of the members of the House vote for articles of impeachment, then that justice is impeached. That's all it takes for impeachment. But all impeachment is a charge. It then goes to the Senate, and the Senate has the sole power to try impeachments, meaning the Senate's going to have a trial. And in that trial, the senators are the jury. You have all the basic rules of due process, right? You have the assistance of counsel, the ability to call witnesses, the ability to compel witnesses in your favor. Evidence is given, and then the Senate votes on the trial of the impeachment. Now, in order for that, for the conviction, there must be 2/3 of the members present must vote to convict on the impeachment. If that happens, then that person is tried and has been impeached and convicted. There are basically, there's only two judgments that can happen. The only thing that could really happen is removal from office and disqualification from holding any office of trust or profit under the United States. So let's say any justice. I don't necessarily want to pick on Justice Sotomayor because I don't think I could find reasons to impeach all 9 of them. But let's say a justice is impeached and convicted. They would be removed from the Supreme Court and they'd be disqualified from holding any office of honor, trust, or profit within the United States. Meaning that justice could no longer be a federal judge. They wouldn't be moved to a lower court. They would be prohibited from holding that office, any office. She couldn't be a judge. They couldn't be a judge. They couldn't be a part of the Department of Justice. They would be disqualified from holding any office, pretty much any office within the United States. Now, why hasn't this happened? In my opinion, this wasn't asked, but we've turned impeachment into a political sideshow. Right? It's not. It no longer is about actual actions. It's political theater. So that's why it isn't used. Why the only time it hasn't been used since the 1990s, except for political reasons, at least that I'm aware of. All right, third question. This comes from my former stomping grounds, a good old-fashioned empire, New York State. Who is this? This is Adriana. Adriana asked this question. She goes, I live in New York where, as you know, tyranny and corruption are present everywhere. Oh, yes, Adriana, that is why I no longer live in the empire. Yes, I am no longer a citizen of the empire. She goes, our children continue to be forced to wear masks all day at school. Parents have brought the issue to BOE, Board of Education, meetings, and all they say is that their hands are tied and that they have to follow the monarch, Queen's Edict, Governor Hochul. Now, several people have tried to sue this unconstitutional mandate, but the courts keep rejecting them. What can we do to help our children so they can have normal childhoods? Wonderful question, Adriana. Absolutely wonderful. And the sad news is, Adriana, you and the other parents are suffering the consequences of decades of failing to hold the elected representatives in Albany accountable to their oaths of office. There's just no other way to put it. That's what's happened. This, by the way, I responded to her and I gave her some ideas and suggestions. But let's look at the stage that she brings it up. So she goes to a Board of Education meeting, and the Board of Education says their hands are tied. Well, yes and no. See, you have state laws and you have the state constitution. Now, I did take a quick look at the state constitution. I haven't looked at that because it makes my head hurt when I read some of these state constitutions. But as I read it, there is nothing in the state constitution that authorizes that basically says the Board of Education is subject to the governor. The Board of Education is subject to the Board of Regents. That is in the Constitution. So the question is, does the Board of Regents have the authority to issue a mask mandate? Did the Board of Regents issue a mask mandate, or was it done under compulsion by originally Governor Cuomo, now kept in place by Governor Hochul? As I understand it, well, and of course, you've got the further problem of this violates the 14th Amendment of the United States. And let me get to that in just a minute. So the Board of Education, the first thing that should be said is, no, your hands are not tied, because show me where the law says, not just a governor's edict. See, governors don't make laws. Governors, they execute the law. They don't make the law. So show me where the legislature of the state of New York gave the governor's office the authority to dictate to the boards of education dress code and medical treatments. Dress code because you're forcing them to wear something, and medical treatments because you're doing it for a public health reason. Show, you know, demand. Don't simply say their hands are tied. Demand that they show you where is the law that this order that they have to wear a mask. Oh, the governor order. What makes that legal? Show me where the legislators of the state of New York authorized this. Show me where the legislature of the state of New York has this authority. And then challenge that with the statement of, well, the 14th Amendment says you cannot deprive people of life, liberty, or property without due process of law. You are depriving the children of their liberty to go about their lives without being impacted, without being controlled by others, and the property they have in their own body. She then went on to say, so don't simply, when they say our hands are tied, that shouldn't, don't leave it there. But that's going to take a little bit of work, a little research on your part. She then said, well, we took these to the courts, and the courts keep rejecting them. Well, again, if you're looking for courts to protect your rights, they're not doing it. Courts gave up on that decades ago. So what you have to do, first of all, is make sure that when you bring this to a court, you are making a strong constitutional argument. It's why I say we need to read and study the Constitution, both of the United States and of our states, so we can not simply say this is unconstitutional, but you can show where it's unconstitutional. You can be specific. You can challenge the judge and say, wait a second, judge, you swore an oath to support the Constitution of the state of New York and the United States. It says right here you can't do that. All right? You need to be willing to stand up and challenge and push back. Now, you're probably going to have a hard time finding a lawyer that's willing to do this, because these lawyers are all cowed by their judges, because they know good and well that if they stand up to the judge is not going to slap them that time. They're going to hold it against them. At least many of them will. So you're kind of in this catch-22. But the next thing is to get it out of the hands of the state cronies. And you're going to have a hard time doing this in New York State, but find a federal judge, make a federal case out of it. Ultimately, the ultimate thing you can do, go with your child, don't let them have them not wear a mask, and when the school bullies try to force them, stand up and protect your child. I mean, ultimately, it's show them the law. I have on my website, go to constitutionstudy.com, search for placard, P-L-A-C-A-R-D. I put this placard together, and I originally it dealt with mask mandates, but it works on so much more. It shows that the Constitution of the United States is the supreme law of the land. The 14th Amendment prohibits you from being deprived of liberty or property without due process of law. That a law created outside of the structure of the Constitution, not authorized by the Constitution, is void, based both on Alexander Hamilton in Federalist Paper 78 and the Supreme Court in Marbury versus Madison. That in doing so, they are violating federal law, Title 18, United States Code, Section 242. Show that to them. See, that's where you have to be armed with information. See, too often, just when they say, well, our hands are tied, show me the law, show me the rule, show me the edict. Prove to me that your hands are tied. We have to do the same thing to all the officials. Be prepared to stand up and to do so with good information, making a good case. See, when John Jay said that we should reinstate the Constitution and teach the rising generation to be free, he said, by knowing your rights, you'll sooner perceive when they're violated and be the better prepared to defend and assert them. So I think that's where we really need to be prepared. And the question that becomes is, how far are you willing to push? Are you willing to go back to the BOE meeting and say, your hands are tied, prove it? See, the BOE works for you, not the other way around. They are public servants, not public masters. Tell them to prove it. Make them stand up. Make that hold up to scrutiny. Don't let them wash their hands of this. Make them be accountable for what they are doing. Find out what their oath of office is. Does it include support for the Constitution of the State of New York and of the United States? Use those against them. Be well armed. That's what we have to do if we wish to live as free people. So I understand the instinct saying, well, the courts will protect me. Yes, we go to the courts to petition our government for redress of grievance, but if that is the sole extent of our ability to protect our rights, then you're not free because you only serve as long as the courts. You're only as free as the courts will let you be. And in America today, that's not all that free at all. Now, I want to thank those who asked for questions. I want to ask those, again, ask your questions at constitutionstudy.com. You can also find out more about my show and get all the latest podcasts by going to America Out Loud. Just look under our show or schedule. You'll find the Constitution Study. Not only will you be in the know, but you can share the blessings of liberty with yourself and with your posterity.
Hey, you'll stay out of jail, love the neighbors, and have a few good friends.